The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens. Joining us for this episode is Dr. Mark McLaughlin, a neurosurgeon at Princeton Brain and Spine Care, who believes that all of us can benefit by taking the core principles behind brain surgery and applying them to any of life's problems. It's a fascinating concept and one which Dr. McLaughlin writes about in an upcoming book.
Doctor, we thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Delighted to be here.
We mentioned you have a fascinating concept and you also have a fascinating background. Share that with us, if you will.
Well, thanks. I'm a neurosurgeon. I've been practicing for 20 years. I'm also a husband of 26 years to my lovely wife, Julie. I have four kids and I'm a former collegiate wrestler.
Wow. Wrestler turned brain surgeon.
Yes, yes. Some people say that I'm a wrestling coach trapped in a neurosurgeon's body.
Well, how'd you get the idea to become a neurosurgeon?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a physician. I used to follow my grandfather around. I don't know if you remember the black bag, but I used to carry his black bag on house calls.
Wow.
And I knew that I wanted to go into medicine. So when I got the chance in college and got an opportunity to go to medical school, I jumped at it and followed my dreams all the way to the University of Pittsburgh for training and got a dream job of becoming a neurosurgeon.
And you said that wrestling and brain surgery are alike in some ways. How so?
Yes, they are. Passion and skill keep you on top. I coach youth wrestling in the Princeton and Trenton area, and I tell my kids every day, it's exactly the same. You have to come to a locker room, put on a uniform, walk into a hallowed ground, and you have to perform. And the stakes are very high, but it's something that wrestling and neurosurgery have a lot in common.
And what about if you're dealing with self-doubt? What strategies do you have for that? Because I would imagine you can't really doubt yourself in the operating room.
Well, I use rules, routines, and rituals. And what the rules are is a series of rules that I was taught my residency during my training that helped me stay out of trouble and save lives. And I added to that some routines that I have in my operating room and then some rituals or sort of superstitions which helped me along the way. But those three helped me navigate the stress of being a neurosurgeon.
Well, tell us more about them. First of all, the rules.
Sure. So the rules, you know, were ingrained in us as residents at the University of Pittsburgh. And my mentor, Dr. Janetta, I remember the first day I was with him, he was operating on somebody's brainstem. And I was watching in the observer side of the microscope. And he said to me, Mark, never cut what you can't see. Never cut what you can't see. And as he was saying it, he was actually humming. I couldn't believe that this guy was so relaxed that he was actually humming while he was dissecting a tiny little blood vessel off of somebody's brainstem. But he had reduced micro neurosurgery to some very basic central rules that if he followed, usually good things were going to happen. And so that was one of the rules he taught me early on. And I started realizing and keeping track of these rules. And as I got more experienced, I really tracked them. And I found that they helped me throughout all of my work and my life.
And what about routines?
Yeah, so we practice these routines, such as some of the rules we talk about. The routines are how you order a particular procedure. So when I'm doing an operation, I have a very specific five P's that I use. I pause. I think exactly who this patient is. Who am I operating on today? Today, it's a 38-year-old man who has a severe disc herniation and sciatica. He needs a perfect operation today. And then I move on to the plan. What is my plan for the surgery? And that is, I'm going to make that incision. I'm going to move the muscles down. I'm going to shave a little bit of bone. I'm going to take the disc out, and I'm going to close. Very quick sort of step-by-step plan in my head. Then I follow with a positive thought. There's nobody that can do this as well as you can. Nobody can do it better. And you are put in this spot right now to help this person. This is why you're here on earth. And then lastly, I say a prayer, and that prayer is to God to help me be the best I can be and help this person. Those are my that's a routine that I have before every operation, and it's really helped me in managing the stress of surgery.
Now, I'm wondering, though, the vast majority of us aren't neurosurgeons or top wrestlers as you've been. Isn't it possible that most of us simply aren't equipped with the kinds of physical or emotional tools that you have, and therefore can't achieve the things that you've achieved or be as good under stress as you are?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm glad you asked that. And I really feel that we all have stresses in our lives, and some of those stresses can be incredible. And it doesn't have to be a neurosurgical life and death experience to have a lot of stress. You can have a lot of stress when you have a child who's making bad choices. You can have a lot of stress when you're trying to communicate and you're not doing a good job with your spouse. You can have stress from anything that comes along in your life. And people think that stress is a bad thing. And my feeling is stress is not a bad thing. Stress is something that's very important in our lives. And it is something that we need to engage. Now, you need to engage it with proper tools. You need proper training. And it's certainly wrestling with stress is a muscle that you need to exercise and practice and flex. So, but I really do believe that it's for everybody, that we need to engage in it. And it's fearful. You know, people are afraid of engaging with stress. But fear, I believe, is an indicator of meaning in your life. If you're fearful of something, that means that you care deeply about something, and you should follow that. You need to understand, uncover what that fear is, and then figure out a way to engage with it. So my thoughts about, you know, these rules, they're universal rules. What does never cut what you can't see mean to the average person? Well, to me, I mean, that means, well, don't make an important decision unless you've really got some space around it. Don't make it under emotional duress. Don't make it quickly. Make sure that you know everything you possibly can about the situation. So those are the kinds of rules that I think can help people engage in stressful situations.
How have you found that people instinctively respond to stress?
Instinctively, we all respond to stress the same way. We have fear and we have a fight or flight response. This is a very primitive part of our brain that was lodged into our operating system for survival when predators were attacking. And the problem is that's not something that's helpful in today's modern world. So we need to first identify that feeling of fear and understand what it's doing to us physiologically. It's making us sweat. It's raising our heart rate. It's dilating our eyes. It's doing a number of things on our body that are not going to really help us make important rational decisions. So we need to recognize that. We need to focus on some breathing and relaxation techniques to get back into a more logical decision-making mode. And then we need to use the courage, which comes from the higher order of the brain, the frontal lobes, and we need to use that courage that we have cultivated over time to deal with the problem at hand.
But how do we tap into that courage when we're in a fearful situation?
That's a great question. And I think what it is you need to kind of have some simple mantras that you can say to yourself to get you into a mode of making a good decision. So what are those mantras for me? Those mantras are be yourself. Try not to be anybody but yourself. Again, look around you. See what's going on. Try and read the faces of people around you. If you can be observant with the body language is, what their facial expressions are, you can understand what that situation is and you can make a better, more educated choice. And then just recognizing that you know, this is normal. It's normal for you to feel that fear. It's normal for you to feel that stress. And the only thing you can do is function as effectively as you can with it. We all have to make decisions with some limited time and some limited amount of information, but we have to be able to engage that and say, okay, well, I've done the best I can. I'm going to make this choice. And you can't be afraid of making mistakes. Mistakes happen. It's part of life.
What has doing such intricate neurosurgery taught you about the importance of staying present?
Concentration is absolutely paramount in neurosurgery. And one of the things I focus on is every single moment when I am doing an operation, for instance, when I use a rongeur is a bone shaver, a bone biter. And we use a rongeur when we're trying to make a window of bone or to remove some arthritis that's pinching a nerve. And every time I bite with that rongeur, it's like a little hole puncher. It takes a little piece of bone away from the nerve. And every time I squeeze that trigger, I need to make sure that the mouth of that rongeur is exactly where I want it, not a millimeter to the right, not a millimeter to the left, not catching the edge of the nerve. Because if I close that on the edge of the nerve, somebody's life has changed forever. So what I focus on is the most important bite is the one you are about to take, not the one before, not the one after. You know, Rudyard Kipling wrote in his great poem, If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. Thinking ahead or thinking about the past is thinking about triumphs and disasters. They're not in the present. You need to focus on the matter at hand, which is take a perfect bite of bone every single time. So I've been blessed because it really does hone your concentration when you're doing these kinds of operations. But it's, again, it's a muscle that I've learned and developed over time. People can use the same kind of concentration technique when they're meditating and relaxing or when they're doing a work task or an important personal task.
But a lot of us freeze up or procrastinate when we're faced with a stressful situation. How do we overcome that?
Little tiny bits of action, little tiny chunks. I tell an experience I had early on in my surgical career when I came upon a tumor that was stuck to a patient's brainstem, right at the base of the brain where the brain meets the spinal cord. And just as I was about to start removing this tumor and shave it off of the side of the spinal cord, I had this little panic in my mind for a split second. And it was this voice of negativity. Oh my gosh, this is, you've taken on too much. You're not capable of doing this. This is out of your hands. You should have sent this person to another doctor, another surgeon. And then I said to myself in my head, what are you talking about? Like, you've trained your whole life for this. This is why you're here. This is what you need to do. You're the person to do this. There's nobody else to do it. And so then I said, okay, get around it, shrink it, remove it. Get around it, shrink it, remove it. Get around it, shrink it, remove it. And I just kept following the edge of the tumor and following that little mantra, those little basic steps. And as I did that, I started getting around the edge of the tumor. I started getting into the center of the tumor and closing it, and it started going my way. And as I did that, I started getting the confidence for this tumor to be removed. And then I finished the case. And you know what I did immediately after that? I went to wrestling practice and I sat down with my young wrestlers and I said, I want to tell you guys, nobody else knows this. You're the first people to know this. I was really scared today working on somebody's brainstem. And I talked myself through it. I had a voice that was telling me that I couldn't do it. And I said, I can just get around it, shrink it, remove it, get around it, shrink it, remove it. And when you're going out on the wrestling mat or when you're doing something challenging in your life, you're going to hear that voice too. Don't listen to it. Focus on your basics, follow them, and you will succeed.
What about if you're dealing with a serious medical issue and you want to get a second opinion? Or if you're dealing with a major life issue like a breakup or trying to decide whether or not to stay with someone, and you want to hear the advice of more than one person, how important do you think that second opinion is?
Well, we have an expression in neurosurgery, and one of my rules is never worry about a patient alone. And what does that mean? I mean, that really means you need to have outside input. One of my mentors taught me that, and her name was Gail Rousseau. She's a neurosurgeon in Chicago. And the same holds true for life. By sharing your worries with others, by getting some other opinions, you gain perspectives and alternative solutions. So when we're faced with stressful events like this, don't trust your gut reaction, because almost always your gut reaction is going to be pure self-preservation, and it's going to be all out of personal bias. And that's something to consider, but it's not the only thing to consider. By getting a trusted colleague or a friend, you get some third-party assessments, and those assessments, I think, are critical in making important decisions. So never worry about a patient alone, and never worry about a problem alone.
What do people do that's wrong, in your view, when it comes to dealing with stressful situations in life?
Avoidance. We have another rule in surgery, and that is little things, little problems not taken care of become big problems. So you need to address it. You know, stress, if you don't apply stress to your bones, you get osteoporosis. If you don't apply stress to your muscles, you get atrophy. If you don't apply stress to your brain, you get dementia. You need to engage these organs with stress. And you have to have the tools to do it, but stress is not to be avoided. It's to be engaged.
What have you learned from doing brain surgery that has been very applicable to how you approach gratitude in your own life?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, I would fall back on another one of my rules. Always place a drain. What I mean by that is when we do surgery on certain brain tumors, the pressure inside the patient's head can be higher than normal. So think about like a Coke can that you shook up, and then you're about to open the top of the Coke can. What happens to the Coke? It sprays out at you. Now, if you've got a head that has pressure in it and you make a hole in it, the brain's not going to spray out at you like a soda, but it's going to come out. It's come out with pressure to almost like a toothpaste coming out of a small hole. So before we make a hole to operate on that tumor, we actually will put a little drainage catheter in a different area, usually more in the front of the brain. And that catheter goes into a fluid pocket and it drains fluid off. It relaxes the pressure so that when we make the hole and we go in to operate on the tumor, the pressure is down. It created a safety mechanism to make the surgery safer. And I think gratitude is a great safety valve. So ask yourself, what are my safety valves? If I'm going into a stressful conversation to talk to my son about something that I'm not happy about, you know, and I know that this is going to be a very tense conversation, let's make a plan. Like, I'm going to talk for about 10 minutes, and if it's going the right way, he seems to be in the right mood, I'm articulating what I want, and we're having a positive interaction, I'm going to let it roll. But if it's not going the way I want, let's pull out. Let's actually plan on having another talk tomorrow morning, maybe at a better time. Having that safety valve is important. If you're giving a lecture, always have a little safety valve out, a safety hatch to get out of the talk in case, let's say you get given a slot of 30 minutes and then somebody that speaks before you speaks for, you know, 15 of your 30 minutes and you got to go to 30, you got to go from 30 to 15 minutes. Have that safety valve so you're not stressed out and you know a way to get out of that. Similarly, gratitude is a way, it's a safety valve to understand how blessed we are in this life and how truly some of the things we worry about are really minuscule in the big picture.
Given your line of work, you're not always giving good news to people. You're oftentimes giving them bad news. And does giving out this bad news make you feel more grateful for your own blessings, or does it make you just feel depressed at the end of the day?
Both. Sometimes it does get depressing. You have to understand that, you know, when you're doing important things, you're not always going to be able to be successful. You're not always going to be able to heal everyone. The consolation I have in those feelings and those events is that when I have to deliver bad news, I give it in the best possible way, and I deliver it just like it's an operation. It's got to be done perfectly. It's got to be done with the right amount of eye contact, the right distance, the right tone, the amount of time that needs to be delivered to that. All of those things are very important. So absolutely, if you don't leave a sad conversation with a family about a malignant brain tumor or someone who's had an irreversible brain injury, I think you ought to hang up your shingle, because it is sad. But you can still move on. You can function in the face of this kind of failure, and you can know that you delivered the message as gently and as caringly as you possibly could have. And then the converse of that is, yes, it does. Being a neurosurgeon, you're cursed because you have a lot of very sad experiences, but you're also blessed because you do see how life can change so suddenly in such a terrible way, such a devastating way. So it's a double-edged sword.
Is there much that is in our control in terms of keeping our brains sharp and healthy over the years?
Definitely, definitely. And some of these things are so basic that you wouldn't believe it. I give a talk on brain health, and some of the things that we can do for our brain health are just to stop doing things that are bad for our brain, like smoking, like drinking too much alcohol, generally one or maybe two drinks maximum a day for the brain. Alcohol is a neurotoxin. Don't forget that. Getting your vaccines, having proper teeth cleanings. You can get bacteria in your teeth, which can lodge in your gums, and it can lodge in your bloodstream, and it can go to your brain. If you have a streptococcal pneumonia vaccination as an elderly person, you can prevent streptococcal meningitis. If you have high blood pressure, you need to treat that high blood pressure, because if you don't, a blood vessel is going to burst in your brain. It's not treated properly. So there are some really basic medical health things that can be done. Clean and regular teeth cleanings. Take the medications that you need to. Avoid insults like smoking and alcohol. And then in addition to that, some supplements are helpful. Some data has shown that vitamin E and some of the B complex vitamins have been helpful. Fish oils that will thin your blood slightly can help. And a Mediterranean diet of fruit and nuts and fish, all very, very helpful for your heart. And if your heart's pumping properly, your brain is going to get better blood supply and better oxygen. Exercise, daily exercise, gets blood flow to your brain, improves the vascular tone in your body, and again, helps your heart pump better to the brain. And then lastly, as I said earlier, stressing your brain. Making sure that you are reading, doing puzzles, strengthening your mind at all times. The higher the IQ you take going into old age is probably one of the few factors that will mitigate against the dementia. So the more you can learn along the way and get habits that are lifelong habits, like reading every morning, working on a crossword puzzle, those sorts of things are very, very helpful. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it.
What advice would you have for someone who may have been given some bad medical news recently in terms of how they can try and mitigate the stress that they have over this issue?
So try to get yourself into a routine. The first routine would be to exercise. Exercise is a powerful antidepressant and pain reliever, and it's going to help you process the information that you've been dealt with. And you need to process it. You can't go around it. You have to go through it. So exercise would be one of my number one suggestions. avoidance of alcohol. Alcohol is going to be something that is, again, it's going to help you avoid the stress and not engage with it. So avoidance of the alcohol. Keep a regular sleep pattern. You may not even sleep, but make sure you get to bed at the same time and make sure you get up around the same time. That's going to keep your sleep cycles as best as possible. Again, never worry about something alone. Share it with people and make sure that you share in set time slots. So in other words, try to get yourself to say, okay, I know I'm going to worry about this. I know I'm worried about dad's diagnosis, but I'm going to worry about it from 10 to 11 today. And I'm going to spend that time talking to somebody, maybe doing a little research on the internet. And then I'm going to finish that at 11 and I'm going to move on to the next task. So try to compartmentalize that into one particular area. It's still going to be with you throughout the rest of the day, but focus on a set time period, and that will help you sort of contain it.
Who do you admire in terms of their ability to deal with stress? What public figures, for example, would you say we ought to look to as examples?
That's a great question. I've never been asked that before. Let me think for a minute. Well, I'm a huge fan of Richard Branson. I think he exudes poise. He is himself in all situations. And I think that the more you just be yourself, the more effective you're going to be, and the more open you're going to be. And I think he's a real lateral thinker too. You know, there's two kinds of thinking. There's vertical thinking and there's lateral thinking. So vertical thinking is very logical. It's step by step. Every single logical point must agree with the point before, and it's linked together. But lateral thinking is when you come up with other iterative pattern reframing concepts. If you think of lateral thinking as kind of like King Solomon, when there was a dispute about whose child, who was the mother of the child. You know, a logical vertical thinker would have said, okay, I'm going to interview this woman who claims to be the mom, and I'm going to find out where the child lived and how this happened. And then I'm going to interview this person, and I'm going to see who's more credible. But King Solomon didn't say that. He said, well, we'll just cut the baby in half. And he looked at the facial expressions of the two mothers. And by seeing their facial expressions, he knew it was the real mother. So Richard Branson, I think, is a lateral thinker like that, and I admire him, and I think he engages stress in a way that makes him very, very effective. I think that's a great, good example.
Doctor, at the end of our show, we always like to ask our guests, what is your nobody told me lesson? So in your case, before you became a neurosurgeon and learned all of these wonderful things, what do you wish you had known then that could have saved you a lot of suffering and stress?
Well, I don't know if you could ever inoculate yourself from this, but I never knew how sad and despondent you can feel sometimes when you do everything you can and things don't go your way. And that's happened to me in my career. And early on in my career, it was really some of the lowest points I've ever felt. And what I did was I turned to God and I said, oh God, I've wanted to be a doctor my whole life, but I have this terrible feeling. I did everything right in this situation and the patient, you know, died, or worse, the patient is suffering terribly. And I prayed to God and for forgiveness and for help and strength. And, you know, I the message back was, you did everything that you could. You didn't give this person their disease. They came to you with this disease. You tried to ease their suffering. You have to move on. You have to move on to the next person. And so over the years, I was able to deal with that more. But in my early years, it was very hard. It was very hard.
Tell us a little bit about your upcoming book and what the title is and that kind of thing, and how people can contact you if they're interested in learning more about your work.
Sure. The book is called Outthinking Fear, A Neurosurgeon's Secrets for Making Life's Hard Decisions. It's going to be published by Scribner, and it'll be out in 2019. I can be picked up on Facebook at Mark McLaughlin, MD, and Instagram, M. McLaughlin, MD. And I'm also on LinkedIn. So I would love to share more stories with you about that. They all sort of came from neurosurgery and lectures that I've given at West Point and to my wrestlers. And it's sort of a culmination of these stories and how they the rules that we talked about really are universal rules. They're the rules of life and business and marriage and parenting and everything else.
And you also have a website.
My website is markmclaughlinmd.com, and my practice's website is princetonbrainandspine.com.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. If anybody's interested in managing stress, there's a stress assessment quiz and some free advice about how to use some of the neurosurgical tools to engage stress better. It's on this website.
Our thanks to our guest on this episode, Dr. Mark McLaughlin, a neurosurgeon at Princeton Brain and Spine Care, who believes all of us can benefit by taking the core principles behind brain surgery and applying them to any of life's problems. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.